on The Voice of America.
This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. Both NATO's chief and Poland's president say a deadly missile strike in Polish farmland yesterday likely was not a Russian attack, AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The preliminary finding?
The incident was likely caused by a Ukrainian air defense missile.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg echoed at the Pentagon.
We have seen nothing that contradicts.
Ukraine, though, is contradicting it, with President Volodymyr Zelensky saying it wasn't our missile or our missile strike. Stoltenberg and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin say they're not blaming Kyiv.
This is not Ukraine's fault.
Russia bears ultimate responsibility for this incident.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
The United States and its allies on Wednesday criticized Russia in the United Nations Security Council over missile attacks on Ukraine in a meeting a day after the missile NATO said was astray, fired by Ukraine's air defenses, crashed into Poland. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky disagrees, saying there's no doubt that the missile was not Ukrainian. Washington's ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, told the Security Council it really doesn't matter.
This tragedy would never have happened but for Russia's needless invasion of Ukraine and its recent missile assaults against Ukraine's civilian infrastructure.
Adding, quote, Ukraine has every right to defend itself against this barrage. South Korea says North Korea has fired a ballistic missile toward its eastern waters. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff says the launch was made Thursday but gave no further details. The launch came hours after North Korea's foreign minister threatened to launch, quote-unquote, fiercer military responses to U.S. moves. This is VOA News. Heavy rains and flooding that swamped Nigeria, Niger, Chad, and the surrounding region between June and October this year was made 80 times more likely by climate change, scientists found. Analysis released late Wednesday by a group of international climate experts found climate change was overwhelmingly behind the heavy rains that left over 800 people dead, with worse to come as average temperatures continue to rise. A space capsule is hurtling toward the moon for the first time in 50 years. The spacecraft with three test dummies aboard launched on top of U.S. space agency NASA's new moon rocket early Wednesday. The Florida launch brings the U.S. a big step closer to putting astronauts back on the lunar surface for the first time since the end of the Apollo program. VOA's Kane Farabaugh was on hand for Artemis's launch and argues the $100 billion price tag to get people back on the moon is worth it.
This is the future of humanity and the future of spaceflight. Success of Artemis will determine whether or not NASA and people can reach Mars. So what they're learning as they return to the surface of the moon, establish a permanent lunar presence on the surface as well as in orbit, all of this is really designed to help NASA and to help those people who are spacefaring explorers eventually reach Mars, which will be a much more complex, a much more intricate mission. So everything that they're doing now is preparing them for that ultimate goal.
The Scrabble dictionary adds hundreds of words, the AP's Ed Donahue reports.
It's almost a certainty a Scrabble player will ask during a game, is that a word? If it's dox, zadonk, or fohawk, the answer is yes. About 500 new words are joining the Scrabble Players Dictionary. There are shortened words like convo and guac, trademarks like dumpster. Compound words are in the book with page view, baby moon, and subtweet. There are also unwords, unfollow, unsub, and unmute. They may sound familiar, but they were never Scrabble official. Also new to the dictionary, whelp, and at least one old-fashioned word that simply fell under the radar for years, yeehaw. I'm Ed Donahue.
The Australian government has confirmed that Novak Djokovic has been granted a visa to compete in the Australian Open in January, a year after he was deported after his stance against the COVID-19 vaccination. The 21-time Grand Slam champion had his visa canceled on public interest grounds on January 14th and lost an appeal against deportation in the full federal court. Australia's immigration minister said he approved the application to revoke the cancellation because the ground for canceling the visa no longer existed. Follow us on the VOA mobile app. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today's Thursday, November 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chino Dorfo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, top U.S. defense chief pledges more aid to Ukraine, but warns that Russia is still a threat despite recent setbacks.
But at the end of the day, Ukraine will remain a free and independent country with its territory intact. Russia could end this war today, right now, but they won't.
More international aid arrives for Ethiopia's Tigray region, ending months-long blockade.
The aid organization said more food will follow imminently through all available routes into Tigray. The news comes a day after two trucks of medical supplies reached Mekele, Tigray's regional capital.
And Qatar prepares to welcome hundreds of thousands of visitors to the 2022 World Cup. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mike Milley has pledged the administration's continuing support to Ukraine in defending its territory against Russian forces for as long as it takes. He, however, cautioned that Kyiv's chances of all near-term outright military victory were not high, despite recent Kremlin setbacks since its invasion in February. General Milley addressed reporters after a virtual meeting between dozens of defense ministers supporting Ukraine's military with billions of dollars in military hardware, as well as training, advising, and intelligence support.
The United States are determined to continue to support Ukraine with the means to defend themselves for as long as it takes. But at the end of the day, Ukraine will remain a free and independent country with its territory intact. Russia could end this war today. Russia could put an end to it right now, but they won't. They're going to continue that fight. They're going to continue that fight into the winter, as best we can tell. And we, the United States, under the direction of the President and the Secretary of Defense, we will continue to support Ukraine for as long as it takes to keep them free, sovereign, independent, with their territory intact. The President of the United States has been very, very clear to us that it's up to Ukraine to decide how and when or if they negotiate with the Russians. And we will continue to support them as long as it takes.
That's Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley. NATO ambassadors held an emergency meeting on Wednesday to discuss Tuesday's missile explosion. Germany rejected a no-fly zone, and Poland said it may not necessarily to invoke the organization's Article 4 clause. Zachary Pekin is a researcher at the Center for European Policy Studies and non-resident researcher with the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy. He discusses the regional security implications of the explosion in Polish territory with VOA Steve Miller.
From what we appear to know so far, and it appears as if information may still be incomplete, it seems to be the case that this was an errant Ukrainian missile that was trying to shoot down a Russian missile that ended up landing in Polish territory, which is certainly reassuring from the standpoint of regional security. But nonetheless, this incident does point to the fact that something like this can happen, whether accidentally or deliberately. It is entirely possible that Russian missiles could end up hitting NATO territory. And of course, as Ukraine continues to make gains on the battlefield, Russia may feel that it has an incentive to escalate the conflict. And this risk has been there since the very beginning of the war, the risk that there could be an escalation of this conflict, which thus far has been limited to Ukraine, to escalate to the level of a direct conflict between NATO and Russia. It could happen via inadvertent escalation, an accidental clash or strike, but it could also happen deliberately. And over the course of the past several years in which we've seen relations between Russia and the West gradually deteriorate, it's been the result of deliberate escalation more often than the result of inadvertent escalation. So I think this just points to the precariousness of the situation we're in right now. And I don't think it's particularly helpful before we know all the facts, when we've got some voices in the West that are immediately calling for us to escalate the situation, immediately to invoke Article 5, immediately to respond by taking drastic measures such as invoking a no-fly zone or striking the Russian Black Sea Fleet. That would amount to a direct war.
Earlier, I mentioned Article 4. You mentioned Article 5, which is commonly referred to as the Collective Self-Defense Agreement, but that's not necessarily true. What are the subtle differences between these two articles, if you could really easily explain it for an international audience?
Well, there's a difference between consultations and it being able to respond militarily or via other means to an attack on one of the members. But it's worth noting that Article 5 does not trigger immediately or automatically military response. You still have to have NATO members come together, decide to invoke it, you know, unanimously, and to be able to contribute, you know, what it is that each one of them chooses to contribute. And each one of them can contribute what they want to a certain extent. So just because something like what happened yesterday happened doesn't necessarily mean that we're directly headed for a NATO-Russia military clash.
That is Zachary Pakin, a researcher at the Center for European Policy Studies and non-resident researcher with the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy. He spoke with VOA's Steve Miller. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on Iranian authorities to immediately release thousands of peaceful protesters from detention and to drop all charges against them. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Nationwide protests sparked by the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini on September 16th, while in police custody, show no sign of going away. Amini was arrested 3 days earlier by Iran's morality police for the alleged improper wearing of the hijab. That event unleashed demonstrations of public anger against the regime not seen since 2019. Observers say more than 14,000 peaceful protesters have been arrested. Last week, Iran's prosecutor said more than 1,000 indictments had been issued against those arrested in Tehran province alone. UN human rights spokesman Jeremy Lawrence says hundreds of other indictments have been issued in the rest of the country.
Human rights law protects the rights of people to peaceful assembly and to freedom of expression. Instead of opening space for dialogue on legitimate grievances, the authorities are responding to unprecedented protests with increasing harshness.
Civil society organizations monitoring events in Iran report excessive force by security forces has led, as of Wednesday, to the deaths of 326 individuals, including 43 children and 25 women. Speaking on behalf of UN human rights officials, Lawrence urges Iran to end its harsh crackdown on peaceful protesters, to immediately release all those in detention, and to drop charges against them. He condemns the decision by Iran's Revolutionary Court Sunday to sentence an unidentified protester to death for allegedly damaging public property. He says at least 9 other protesters have been charged with offenses that carry the death penalty.
Under international law, countries that have not yet abolished the death penalty may only impose it for the most serious crimes, which is interpreted as crimes of extreme gravity involving intentional killing.
The UN Human Rights Office is calling on the Iranian authorities to immediately impose a moratorium on the death penalty and to revoke death sentences issued for crimes that do not qualify as the most serious crimes. Lawrence says his office is in contact with the Iranian authorities and has been in communication regarding the investigations they have carried out into Mahsa Amini's death. A statement issued Friday by Iran's forensic organization concluded that, quote, Mahsa Amini's death was not caused by blows to the head and vital organ and limbs of the body. This contradicts claims made by her parents that Amini died of a violent blow to the head by police officers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. And more international aid is arriving in Ethiopia's Tigray region, ending a months-long blockade after the warring sides agreed to a ceasefire. Fred Hatta reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The UN's Food Programme, or WFP, said Wednesday that its trucks had arrived in northwest Tigray via Gonda, a city in the Amhara region to the south. The aid organisation said more food, nutrition, medical cargo will follow imminently through all available routes into Tigray. The news comes a day after 2 trucks of medical supplies from the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, reached Mekele, Tigray's regional capital. 2 years of war in the northern region have displaced an estimated 2.5 million people from their homes and left millions more in need of food aid and other basic necessities. The ICRC said Wednesday that a test flight had arrived in Shire, a city in northwest Tigray that hosts hundreds of thousands of people uprooted by recent fighting. The resumption of airlifts could alleviate the suffering of thousands needing immediate support, the ICRC said. The Gondar route, used by the WFP convoy, had been closed to aid groups since June, when federal forces and their allies retreated from Tigray in the face of an offensive by rebel forces led by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. Over the weekend, military leaders from both sides reached an agreement laying out a roadmap for implementing the ceasefire, which was signed in Pretoria on November 2. The accord contains security guarantees for humanitarian workers and pledges the parties to facilitating unhindered humanitarian access to Tigray, although phone, internet and banking services have not yet been restored to the region. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
In other news, UN nuclear watchdog chief Rafael Grossi called on Iran on Wednesday to, quote, start to deliver, unquote, information on its nuclear program, saying Tehran had to go, quote, by the rules, unquote. Grossi criticized Tehran of supplying, quote, answers characterized as technically not credible, unquote. There is currently an impasse between the IAEA and Tehran over uranium traces found at undeclared sites. Grossi also said he had a very, quote, simple message, unquote, for the warring factions in Ukraine and around the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, quote, don't shoot at the plant, don't shoot from the plant, unquote. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. The political and diplomatic fallout is growing after Sunday's bombing in Istanbul. Turkey blames Kurdish militants backed by the United States for the attack, which comes months before elections. For VOA, Doria Jones reports from Istanbul.
Mourners have not stopped laying flowers at the scene of Sunday's fatal bomb attack on Istanbul's most famous shopping street. While the country comes to terms with the bombing, the political repercussions are growing. After detaining the alleged bomber, Turkish security forces claim the attack was carried out by the Kurdish militant group, the PKK, a charge the group denies. Devlet Bahçeli, leader of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's parliamentary coalition partner, the MHP, called Tuesday for the closure of Turkey's legal Kurdish party, the HDP.
Türkiye Büyük Millet Meclisi'nde bölücü sima istemiyoruz.
Bahçeli said the coalition does not want to see separatists in the parliament. He said its members cannot stand seeing terrorists and cannot tolerate, even for a second, the HDP. The HDP is already facing closure, with many of its parliamentary deputies already in jail over links to the PKK. Convictions the European Court of Human Rights has condemned as politically motivated. In a statement, the jailed former HDP leader, Selahattin Demirtas, warned the government could use Sunday's bombing as a pretext to launch a new offensive into Syria against Kurdish forces of the YPG. Turkey's interior minister, Süleyman Soylu, has claimed the alleged Sunday bomber confessed to being trained by the YPG, a group Ankara claims is affiliated with Kurdish militants of the PKK. Washington backs the YPG in its war against the Islamic State terrorist group. Soylu dismissed condolences by the American ambassador, likening them to a murderer returning to the crime scene. Professor of International Relations Senem Aydın Duzkit of Istanbul's Sabancı University says there is a large audience in Turkey for anti-American rhetoric.
Well, there is a lot of anti-Americanism in Turkey and anti-Westernism. I mean, some of it historical, ideological, you know, because you have anti-Americanism both on the right and also on the left of the political spectrum. And this is not just something that's sort of unique to the right wing of the political spectrum, but the left suffers from it as well.
But any diplomatic discord between Ankara and Washington appears for now to be contained, with Erdogan meeting US President Joe Biden Tuesday on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Indonesia. But analysts suggest the real fallout could be next year's presidential elections, with Erdogan and his AKP party languishing in the polls. Soli Özel, who teaches international relations at Istanbul's Kadir Has University, says Sunday's bombing stokes fears that history could be repeating itself.
It rekindles the fears that we might find ourselves in a situation similar to the period between June 7, 2015 and November 1, 2015, when we had a repeat election. On the 7th of June, the AKP lost its absolute majority in the parliament. An alternative government could not be formed. So we went to a repeat election. And in between that period of time, violence escalated. There were terrorist incidents before the repeat election took place.
Erdogan's AKP party won the November 2015 election with a large majority. Opposition parties are already raising questions over the speed and swift conclusions of the investigation into the Sunday bombing. Observers say the opposition's scrutiny of the government's handling of the investigation is likely to grow as elections draw closer. Doreen Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
Qatar is preparing to welcome hundreds of thousands of visitors to the 2022 World Cup, and many local businesses are eager to receive them. For many tourists, it's a chance to see this part of the world for the first time. VOA's news reporter Celia Mendoza has this story from Doha, Qatar.
When the sun goes down, the streets of the Souq Waqif, local market in Doha, Qatar, are transformed, welcoming locals and tourists. The market is full of colorful merchandise, unique smells, and traditional food. For visitors and locals, it is a chance to see an older Qatar, full of rustic businesses with handmade signs that contrast with the large buildings and shopping centers of the city. Jamal Abdullah, who has a souvenir store and sells traditional items from the Middle East, hopes the 2022 World Cup will bring more clients. The Emirate government expects more than 1 million people to travel to the country during the 2022 World Cup, which kicks off on November 20. Qatar has a population of about 2.7 million. Lucia Masurati and Martin Curen are an Argentinian couple living in Doha. They say the event will unite people from around the world through their common passion for soccer.
I think they are going to receive them very positively.
There are people from all countries supporting Argentina. One of the largest communities that supports Argentina here is from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. I never would have imagined.
Locals and business owners expect the 2022 World Cup to be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Qatar, which is traditionally very conservative, also announced some easing on some traditional Islamic restrictions like alcohol consumption and public noise in the hopes of drawing tourists. But not everything is changing. The traditional Islamic restriction on eating pork will remain in place. Celia Mendoza, VOA News, Doha, Qatar.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have long wondered about when early humans started to use fire to cook food. A new discovery may provide an answer. Researchers from three Israeli universities, in collaboration with other institutions, have found proof of prehistoric humans using fire to cook food that predates previous evidence by more than 600,000 years. According to a press release from Tel Aviv University, the scientists performed a rigorous examination of the remnants of what was described as a carp-like fish. The remains were found at an archaeological site in Israel, and the researchers' analysis indicates that the fish was cooked about 780,000 years ago. They point out that until their discovery, the earliest proof of food being cooked for consumption dates back some 170,000 years ago. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
It really was powerful because it showed what is possible when men and women band together and say enough is enough.
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation. Each week, right here on The Voice of America, on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including leaders of the world's largest economies are gathered in Indonesia. Tensions over Russia's war on Ukraine raises questions about whether they would be able to unite on what is one of the most pressing issues globally, and with Russia being a member of the G20 group. We'll discuss this and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter. Next up, 2 years after a so-called military operation morphed into a civil war, the African Union brokered a ceasefire between Addis Ababa and representatives of the Tigray region. We talked with two former ambassadors to Ethiopia to evaluate the sustainability of the ceasefire, as well as to take stock of the humanitarian and economic toll the war has taken on the people of Ethiopia. That's Encounter, Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Protests have been growing inside and outside Iran, initially sparked by the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini, a young woman arrested by Iran's morality police for not having her hair fully covered. Each Wednesday, go beyond the breaking news with VOA's Flashpoint Iran. Listen online at voanews.com or in your podcast player.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinedu from Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the resumption of fighting by the March 23rd Movement Armed Group, or M23, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said in a written statement, "The resumption of hostilities since October 20th has caused significant human suffering, including deaths and injuries among civilians, and significant numbers of newly displaced persons. The United States calls for an immediate cessation of hostilities and respect for human rights and international humanitarian law." M23 is a militant group operating in eastern DRC, made up of rebels who defected from the DRC's armed forces. There are credible reports it is supported by the government of Rwanda. The M23 and some of its leaders, including Sultani Makenga, have been sanctioned by the United States and the United Nations for horrific attacks on civilians. M23 fighters recently seized multiple towns and two major roads in the DRC's North Kivu province. At least 20 civilians were killed, at least 50 were injured, and 6 peacekeepers from the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or MONUSCO, were injured. The offensive has displaced an estimated 475,000 people since October 20th, with another 200,000 unable to leave occupied areas. The United States calls for M23 to withdraw from its positions, disarm, and rejoin the Inter-Congolese Dialogue, Nairobi process, in preparation for disarmament, demobilization, and community reintegration offered by the government of the DRC, said State Department spokesperson Price. At a Security Council briefing, Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative of Special Affairs, called on Rwanda to cease its support for the M23 and noted that MONUSCO remains critical to bringing peace to eastern DRC and the broader region. It serves an important purpose, protecting civilians, disrupting illicit networks, and helping stabilize governance and security institutions, he said. Ambassador Wood emphasized achieving peace is contingent upon a political process, political will, and political solutions. To that end, he said, the United States announced in September an additional $30 million in funding to support a transparent electoral process in the DRC, strengthening democratic institutions, bringing justice to victims, holding bad actors to account, respecting states' territorial sovereignty and integrity, and prioritizing civilians will help bring peace to the Great Lakes. The people of the region deserve nothing less.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.